Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we are taking a bit of a detour. This week's feature interview has absolutely nothing to do with InfoSec, but it's sort of, it's a bit of a stretch, but it's kind of related to the internet. This week's feature guest is John Safran. He has been gracing Australian television screens for something like 20 years. He's very well known here. But John is also an author, and I've just finished reading his latest book, which is called Depends What You Mean by Extremist, Going Rogue with Australian Deplorables. And honestly, it's fascinating enough for me to just sort of shoehorn it into this program. Basically, John spent a year and a half hanging out with all sorts of extremists. Your Marxists, your anarchists, your right-wing, anti-Islam, anti-immigrant types, and even Islamic State supporters, some of whom are now in prison awaiting trial for terrorism-related charges. Now, I speak to John this week about the internet's influence on extremism, as well as extremism in general and his experiences in writing this book. Now, even if you're not Australian, I highly, highly recommend this book. It's a fascinating look at the contemporary political landscape through the eyes of extremist movements of all flavours. And it's not a tough read. It's actually quite funny. And it is the most on-point thing I have read in a long, long time. This week's show is brought to you by Bug Crowd. Big thanks to them. And in this week's sponsor interview, we'll chat with Casey Ellis, Bug Crowd's founder and CEO. Now that outsourced bug bounties have gone mainstream, in a sense, we know more about what they're for, I guess is the best way to put it, and also how people find them useful. So we speak to Casey about how a lot of organisations are basically just throwing the lower value testing out to bounties to free up their InfoSec teams to do higher order work. We talk about that and a couple of other points that is coming up in this week's sponsor interview. But before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, I warn you in advance, I have been suffering terribly at the hands of Conflu this week, so you're going to have to carry me through this one. And the first story this week, of course, is Shadow Brokers. We've already spoken about how they were planning their monthly subscription service, throw them 20 grand of Zcash and you too can have some sweet, sweet NSA zero day. And they're hyping their first release, which is going to come in June, apparently.
Yeah, it's pretty funny actually seeing them do this. I mean, they have been hyping it up, and they've started to release some details about how to pay for it with Zcash and how they're going to deliver the details of this stuff in advance. And it's kind of a funny story to watch unfold, because you really do get the impression that they're just kind of taking the piss. They'll get some money out of it. It's not going to be clearly a long-term subscription process. But, yeah, it's been interesting watching the sort of hand-wringing about the pragmatic side, and B, it's $20,000, and B, the sort of the ethics of actually paying a crime group, that's probably the Russians, to sell you stolen NSA wares. But, we're going to see it one way or the other, because obviously it'll come out once someone gets hold of it in June. But, yeah, it's kind of funny just watching it all unfurl.
Yeah, well, people are even trying to crowdsource 20 grand so they can get a subscription and stuff like that. And I'm just like, don't play their game. Come on. And my favorite conspiracy theory on this one is that Matthew Green and his compadres cooked this whole thing up. It's a long play. They cooked it all up to make more people use Zcash.
Yeah, Zcash is the kind of zero-knowledge Bitcoin fork that's designed for, better anonymity and stuff. But yeah, maybe this will pump it up and they'll make some sweet, sweet founder cash.
Yeah, I might need to adjust Matthew Green's position on the Risky Business quartered rhombus of cyberownage, given that he's now a one-man threat actor. So something to keep in mind. The Wall Street Journal, meanwhile, has a really fascinating report here relating to all of the Gucci for Two Russian stuff. Apparently, a GOP operative in Florida was getting super cozy with the old Guccifer, which, in light of what we know now, probably isn't a great look.
No, this guy, Aaron Nevins, who's some sort of, Republican-ish blogger in Florida, reached out to Guccifer sometime after the NC breaches and managed to kind of get hold of some of the data from them, including apparently some of the plans about how they were going to do on-the-ground, encouragement for people to actually get out and vote. At the time, he exchanged some messages with Guccifer on Twitter, kind of asserting how valuable that information was and how great, and he did some analysis of it. And he's on record actually saying that it didn't matter who Guccifer ever was, because, quote, if your interests align, never shut any doors in politics, end quote, which, yeah, given what we now know, probably isn't exactly what the Republicans want want to be happening, because, yeah, not such a good look.
Look, an interesting thing in this whole story is it's not really clear from the reporting how we know all of these wonderful things about said GOP operative in Florida, right?
Yeah, no, that bit seems to have been glossed over rather in the reports we've been reading. But yeah, I'm sure it's going to come out. This whole thing does seem to be unraveling rather for the Republicans.
In further news, Ars Technica reports that surprise, surprise, Russian influence op people actually mess with documents before they release them, inserting disinformation. I mean, color me surprised.
I know, exactly right. That's hardly a stunning revelation there. We saw accusations of it, you know, being edited, I think it was in the French campaign around Brexit, some of the documentation that was being leaked there as well. But yeah, there's been a campaign that's been in flight against a number of journalists and other people, you know, critical of the Russian regime. And yeah, some of the documents stolen from some particular reporter's email apparently has been edited subsequent or prior to its release by the hacker. So yeah, interesting seeing that happening quite so sort of overtly now.
Yeah, this is all based on some stellar work from Citizen Lab, which actually convinced this journalist to actually, talk about it publicly, which is great. It's great that someone who was affected by one of these campaigns has actually felt free to talk about it, so that's great. ThreatPost has an interesting story up about WannaCry. Apparently the ransom note, some linguistic analysis, says that the ransom note was written by people who speak both Chinese and English, which is a very interesting data point when we're trying to sort of throw some blame at North Korea on this thing.
Yeah, so the analysis here is that, you know, obviously the WannaCry ransomware had ransom notes in a number of languages, and the bulk of those were machine translated from the English. But when they looked at the Chinese, both the simplified and the traditional Chinese ones, those are the only ones that stand out as being written by an actual native speaker. They include some idiomatic terminology. They kind of use some words that are more common in particular areas of, you know, of southern China and Hong Kong and Singapore. And yeah, it has, there's a few things that are omitted from the Chinese version that are, you know, that are not in the English version, and then subsequently, of course, are not in any of the other machine translated ones. And the English one, you know, doesn't really read like a native speaker. There's also a typo in the original Chinese, which you wouldn't make if it was machine generated. So that's one of the other data points they're using to kind of point at it. There's a number of things that suggest that that was the original language it was written in. And then you know, sort of the next question is whether or not that means anything about attribution in terms of North Korea. And of course, you know, there's a pretty strong relationship between China and North Korea. Lots of education and people, you know, who are work. You know, it's quite the idea that the Lazarus Group is an outsourced, you know, an organization that the Koreans outsource, the North Koreans outsource their hacking to, you know, that there would be Chinese people in there is not at all surprising. So it doesn't really add or detract from the attribution question for North Korea, but it's certainly an interesting data point.
Yeah, it is. And look, in my mind, I've got no idea whether or not this was North Korea, but you cannot dismiss the link. You know, there is a link there. The question is really how it got there and what the relationships are, not whether or not there's a link. So,
yeah,
you know,
I agree, yes.
In the fullness of time, I'm sure we will come to understand what was involved here. And, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, I've said it before on the show, but North Korea have been up to all sorts of shady stuff, you know, from the Swift attacks against the Bangladeshi bank to smuggling boatloads of heroin into Australia. Like, these guys will try to make money any way they can. Ars Technica, meanwhile, is reporting that Trump these days has an iPhone. You know, he switched over from his Galaxy S3 or whatever, you know, his bug-riddled Galaxy S3. And now he's using an iPhone that only has Twitter on it, which is, you know, seems oddly appropriate for him.
Apparently, previously, there was one of his like social media director was also posting on his account, and people were able to kind of tell it apart based on the fact that the social media guy had an iPhone and Trump used an Android. And now that they're both using iPhones, it's kind of harder to tell them apart from the Crazy Town content. So I guess people could focus on that instead.
How do we know it's only got Twitter on it, though?
Yeah, so Ars credits that to an article on the site Axios.com, I've never heard of, and they are asserting that they got told that it was the only app on his phone. So, you know, who knows what the actual source is or how true it is. Maybe it's fake news.
That's the theme of 2017, isn't it? Who knows?
Who knows? It's crazy time.
ThreatPost, meanwhile, is carrying a story that looks into a Cisco Talos report about the abuse of, you know, free HTTPS, you know, certificate authorities to, you know, make phishing and whatnot more convincing. I mean, this is something we flagged as a possible issue, you know, months ago, and it looks like it's certainly coming true.
Yeah, we spent so long telling people to look for the stupid padlock because of the HTTPS. And yeah, now, of course, let's encrypt, let's everybody get certificates really, really easy. And people are falling for all sorts of things because of that, which, yeah, I guess is not a surprising consequence of Let's Encrypt. But, you know, the whole PKI infrastructure is rubbish anyway. So, you know, what are we
It kind of reminds me, I just had this thought when I was reading this, is I remember, you know, many, many years ago, it might have even been in the 90s or the early 2000s. I think it was the early 2000s when Bill Gates suggested that a way to eliminate spam was to turn email into a paid for service, right? So you'd pay for like an e-stamp, which is of course an awful, awful idea. But he gets points for thinking about the economics of it, right? Because fundamentally, you can still send spam, but if there's a cost to it, you're less likely to do that. And that's the thing with Let's Encrypt. It's not that we're saying, you know, Let's Encrypt is a horrible organization for wanting to give people free, you know, DV certs. But the point is, you know, when you change the economics, you change attacker behavior, and we're really seeing it now.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, the you know, much as I resent paying certificate authorities to do essentially nothing except take my money and, you know, sign a thing, yeah, it does create an economic disincentive to just having certs on everything. And of course, you know, we use Let's Encrypt certs on all our attack infrastructure. It's great. It works really well. So yeah, Whereas previously, I would resentfully spend money.
So have you noticed that when you're spear phishing one of your clients, when you actually run it, you know, run the domain through Let's Encrypt and have, you know, your nice little green text and whatever, you actually get better click-throughs?
Well, actually, it's almost more useful for command and control. Making sure everything's encrypted on the wire means generic IDS doesn't see anything. So, yeah, that's the main reason for having valid certs everywhere. The phishing side of things, people are going to click on anything anyway. So, you know.
Nice. Oh, God. Microsoft having a bad time with its AV. Project Zero found more bugs in its, you know, malware protection engine or whatever. And, you know, it's sad because for a long time we were sort of holding Microsoft up as the, hey, at least they've, you know, written a decent engine that, you know, can parse stuff and not kill you. But doesn't seem that that's necessarily the case.
Yeah, it turns out we were totally wrong there. Yeah, once Google's managed to get this into their fuzzing harness or whatever they're doing to find all these sweet bugs, yeah, that turns out really is really, really not the case. Taurus and friends over at Project Zero have turned up another set of bugs in the x86 emulator that the Microsoft malware engine uses to kind of emulate stuff to see whether it's going to be malicious or not. Apparently it's not sandboxed at all, and it just kind of, you know, there's ways to control the execution of the emulator from inside the emulator, which is, you know, doesn't seem like the world's best design ever. But anyway, Microsoft patching a bunch of bugs on those in that particular area. So yeah, I'm sure we'll see some details crop up relatively soon. Not quite as bad as the last one they found, but yeah, it's AV is just, you know, is not a good thing from a security perspective, unfortunately. And that appears to include Microsoft's one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends, right? It depends. It always depends.
Oh, of course. Depends on your threat model and your environment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. We've got to throw that disclaimer in there. That was like the equivalent of, you know, me throwing up an asterisk, and that was the footnote. Hey, just speaking of that last bug that we spoke about, you know, a couple of weeks back that Tavis found, it wasn't actually just Tavis. He worked very closely with Natalie Silvanovich on that one. And we didn't credit her when we originally spoke about that bug, and that was an oversight on our part. I guess when there's just one name you know, that's the one you tend to hang the discussion on. So apologies to Natalie for that one. 1Password, the password manager, has introduced a travel mode, which is an interesting idea that maybe is also not fully thought through, shall we say.
Yeah, so the basic gist of this is that you can turn on a travel mode in your password manager, and it will remove a bunch of your passwords from your device whilst you're traveling, which on the face of it seems like it might address some problem, but it really doesn't deal with the kind of the bigger picture issue of, you know, are you cooperating with you know, customs agents whilst you're in the border and your rights are arbitrarily suspended or whatever. So it's, you know, one of those sort of technological solutions to a problem that's really fundamentally not technological. So of course it doesn't actually work ideally in the real world, and whether or not anyone will actually use this and then get any benefit from it, I don't know. But it's non-technical problem.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, I mean, a lot of the discussion that happens in the technical community is like, oh, well, if I just, you know, encrypt it with this and whatever, and, you know, I won't give them the password. And then they say, well, you have to give us a password and a passphrase, or just unlock this via any tool at your disposal, or we're going to put you in the clink, right? So that's the issue. You're not going to fix this with tech. It's got to be fixed through law, right?
Well, exactly, yeah. And that's the challenge here is, you know, your credentials are still stored in the web servers and they will just compel you to log into that and turn off travel mode, you know, end of technical argument.
Yeah. More drama in Sambaland, although this time it's Linux. And this is probably going to be a lot worse than people might necessarily realize because there's an awful lot of Samba out there.
Yeah, this bug unfurled, I think, just after we went to news last week. And, man, what a doozy. Like, you can, for versions of Samba.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you can sort of think, like, how the hell was that there for 7 years? You know?
I know, right? It's such an awful bug. Essentially, you can convince the Samba server to load a shared library into itself, and that shared library can be on the Samba share if you've got writable access. So you're just going to upload a shared library and then instruct the server to load it into itself and execute, which of course is a terrible idea, and gains, you know, remote root command exec. And yeah, versions of Samba going back about 7 years. And of course, it's not just, you know, Linux on the desktop hippies that run Samba. There's a lot of Samba in embedded systems, you know, network filers, NAS storage systems, home routers, like pretty much anywhere that talks Windows file sharing that isn't Windows is Samba of some variant. Some of the variants are quite old. And I think someone looked at the applicability of this bug to, say, NetApp filers, and it did appear that they forked off from Samba far enough in the past that they weren't vulnerable to this particular bug. But there is just a lot of Samba.
Yeah, there is. I mean, think about any single, like, home NAS, you know, which most of those aren't going to go out to the internet. But, I mean, you saw in the case of Hacking Team, their NAS actually played a role in them getting so thoroughly owned, right? Because they were able to extract backups from it. I mean, that's just something that's going to be on a lot of networks that is probably not going to get a patch.
Well, exactly, yeah. And similarly, you know, customer premises devices you get from your ISP, a lot of those have like a, you know, share a USB stick that's plugged into me feature. That's just embedded Linux running Samba. You know, there's a lot of things going to get a lot of owned. And this is one of these bugs that as a pen tester, you look at and think, yeah, this is going to be a real long tail one that I'm going to be owning stuff with, you know, for 5-10 years to come.
Yeah.
It's not a flash in the pan one like, you know, some of the Windows bugs.
One of the funny things too about, you know, SMB file shares and stuff is I was having a conversation with someone recently who was pointing out that like a lot of even security software will disable your firewall rules to allow Samba through because it gets definitions or whatever that way, you know, like enterprise software. You think, why on earth would you allow Samba open even to your LAN? And it's because, you know, a lot of the time this enterprise crapware actually turns it on for you.
Yeah, and there's a lot of reasons where, what, you know, where and why it might show up in your own printers and, you know, embedded systems and all sorts of things.
Yeah, but cameras, I'm talking like your Win 7, you know, Win 8 desktops, like, or Win 10, I should say.
Security software, man. It's just, yeah, what am I going
to do? Oh, now, Joseph Cox is banging this drum. He's been banging this drum pretty hard for a while now, but he's dug up a court transcript that shows that Department of Justice and FBI executives approved the sting against Playpen, which, you know, I mean, I think it's kind of good that they ran this up the chain and they allowed senior people to make that call. So it shows that they actually thought about it, but it's sort of, he's sort of written it up as a bit of a gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you would certainly hope that before you ran, you know, a large-scale child pornography site on the internet in the name of law enforcement, that you would in fact talk to your lawyers. And yeah, I don't know that it is a super gotcha that they in fact did go and talk to their general counsel, you know, the FBI and Department of Justice to, you know, get approval to do that. Which, yeah, I'm not sure that there is a bit of a hook in here for them.
I mean, you look at the number of convictions they got, and I understand that this whole Playpen thing has raised a lot of very sticky legal questions, and I think that's good, that's healthy. But at the same time, I find it really hard to criticize the DOJ or the FBI for actually taking over this site and running a sting just for long enough to be able to collect the intel to get convictions. Do you know what I mean? People are sort of making it out like they've been, you know, they're in the kiddie porn business, or there's an element of entrapment in it, and I just don't see that.
No, they didn't run it for a particularly long time, and yeah, the outcome did seem kind of worthwhile. I mean, you know,
they've taken over carding forums in the past. I think just because it's child exploitation material, it's just a much more, you know, emotional topic. I mean, do you see that as being a reason why this is getting so much play?
Yeah, totally agree. I'm sure that is why it is. Because we see them running, as you say, carding forums, we've seen them running VPN services, you know, all that kind of thing, hosting environments. This one is really just particularly different because of the nature of the content and the material and the idea that the government would run, you know, allow that to continue operating for a second longer than it needed to. But you know, the overall goal perhaps is worth it.
Moving on, and look, one of the reasons that the shadow brokers might have switched away from Bitcoin to Zcash, right, is because Bitcoin As much as it's the favored tool of crooks, it is entirely traceable. And Motherboard has also reported that authorities have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. The FBI, the DEA in America, also Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they've spent a bunch of money on some, you know, blockchain forensics tools that help you trace Bitcoin around. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, that seems like a fairly decent use of police resources, because tracing stuff through the blockchain, even if you're using tumblers, it's not as hard as you might necessarily think.
Yeah, but it's one of these things that's kind of fiddly, and you can imagine that buying in an outside product that kind of does everything you need and gives you a nice, understandable for investigators output, you know, would be a good use of your time and money versus actually having to develop that capability internally. So yeah,
or doing it manually, like in Analyst Notebook doing it by hand. Yeah, like
that's no fun at all.
No fun at all. So there you go. Motherboard also has this story about this this person who used the handle Ping, and they were running a notorious dark web hacking forum. They were arrested in 2015, but details have emerged that that say that this guy was like a 15-year-old kid in Canada.
Yeah, and apparently he got picked up because he hacked into the administration system of his school. Like, he keylogged a teacher and then used that access to fish credentials for their school attendance and grade keeping system. And then they rolled him up for that and found a bunch of information tying him to this particular forum, the Hell hacking forum, I think it was.
Yeah, he got caught for something stupid, basically.
Basically, yeah, and he sent the phishing emails from an email account that he'd set up on his neighbor's wireless, but unfortunately he'd logged into the jacket from his own machine as well. So yeah, kind of pretty much basic OPSEC failure there, guy. When you're
15,
posting things on,
he'll learn, you know.
Well, he'd definitely get better. He's doing better OPSEC at 15 than I was, I'm sure. So.
Well, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Pretty tame news week, but you know, I've got to be careful saying that, because it feels like every time I say that, the next week is a doozy. And we've got another show for you all next week, and then I am going on vacation for 2 weeks. I'm going somewhere tropical. I've booked a very nice hotel on the top of a cliff, and I'm going to be very relaxed. So, Blue Teamers, repent, basically, is what I'm trying to say. But, mate, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Are you going on holiday right when the Shadow Brokers are going to drop the next round of bad stuff? Because
the thought did occur to me, because when they announced June, I'm like, hang on, isn't that when my holiday is coming? So that's when all the O-Day is coming, all of it.
Have we ever seen the Shadow Brokers and Patrick Gray in the same room at the same time? I don't think so. Think about it, sheeple.
I'll be on a tropical cliff top, spending all of that sweet Zed cash.
Spending your Zcash.
Yeah, that's right. All right, mate, thanks again, and until next Wednesday.
Cheer, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with John Safran, an Australian author and TV, I don't even know what you'd call him, because TV personality just sounds wrong. You can sort of think of John as roughly like sort of Australia's Louis Theroux. In fact, there's actually a Louis Theroux quote on the back of his new book, which is titled Depends What You Mean by Extremist, Going Rogue with Australian Deplorables. Louis Theroux says John's book is funny and gripping and wonderfully weird, a tremendous book. I can't praise it too highly. Now, I compare John to Theroux in that they both have this sort of disarming curiosity, which means people will talk to them when it really just doesn't make sense. As an example, John is Jewish, and yet he was able to hang out and chat over cups of tea with hardcore Australian jihadis and hardcore Australian Nazis, which, you know, you just wouldn't expect to happen. And, you know, he also hangs out with the Marxists, the anarchists, the garden variety anti-immigration types. He just tries to collect every flavor of extremist for his new book. What makes John different to Theroux is he's a lot funnier. And over the last 20 years or so, John has produced some of the most hilarious television I've ever seen. Some of the titles he's produced and starred in are John Safran's Music Jamboree, Race Relations, and my personal favorite, John Safran versus God. I'll drop a link to the first episode of John Safran versus God into this week's show notes, a YouTube link, and I'd highly recommend you watch it because it is very funny. Over the last 20 years, we've watched John road test religions, go deep on peyote, do a nudie run through Jerusalem, and convince a witch doctor on the Ivory Coast to put a curse on his ex-girlfriend. He even tried to convince a senior judge on the UK Sharia court to place a fatwa on a very famous TV host here in Australia who John was annoyed with. So yeah, it's not often that I do an interview that basically has nothing to do with security, but I'm a huge fan of John's, like a lot of Australians. And I read this book and look, it's just so on point that I had to break with the norm and do this. So here goes. The last couple of years has seen the rise of extremism on both the left and the right of the political spectrum and across seemingly all religions. To people who consider themselves squarely welded to the secular political center, like myself, it's been a hell of a thing to watch. And at times, I just haven't understood quite how we got here. And this book really helped me to understand. And it was a really fun read as well. Now, one thing we can point to on how we got here is the internet. In the good old days, Nazis and religious fundamentalists and, hardcore anarchists used to have to go to funny bookstores to hang out with each other and discuss their ideas. These bookstores would usually have sheet metal over the windows because people would usually smash them in, and they'd be located in very strange locations, like down dead-end streets in industrial areas. But that's all changed. These days, you're only a couple of clicks away from myriad Facebook communities that serve to reinforce and enhance any particular prejudice you happen to hold. But as you'll hear, John thinks hardcore extremists of all stripes will always find a way to pursue their interests, shall we say, social media or not. Here's John.
What I found interesting about comparing pre-social media or pre-internet to internet is that in the old days, if you were radical and, for instance, you printed up a book, there would be something about the font in the book or the spine, like something would just be a bit off. That would really signal to you that, oh, this isn't out through Penguin Books. This isn't out through HarperCollins. And similarly, if someone handed out pamphlets to you on the street, like the writing would all be a bit too tight and the photocopying would look a bit shonky. And it really signaled to you that, oh, this is something outside the mainstream, like this is radical or weird or something. Whilst with the internet, there's just like templates. So you can be someone who is deeply radical, but your template, because of templates and standardization, you can pretty easily look as professional as the people behind the Coca-Cola website or the people behind...
So good ideas look about the same as bad ideas in the internet age.
Yes, and I think another thing I find interesting about social media and radicalism is I remember when first the internet was and Google was showing that, look, Christ, anyone can post anything, that suddenly mysteries were going away. So, for instance, with Scientology and also with Freemasonry, they held so much of their power by the fact that they had secrets that you couldn't get to. And there's such an energy in like people on the outside not knowing what's going on. And so Scientology documents were leaked online and Freemason things. And suddenly I was thinking to myself, oh, is the age of mystery over? So is that whole power you can gain by holding secrets all gone? But then I noticed with spending 18 months or whatever following these radical groups and also following them on social media, but I mean, not only, clearly, but that they kind of regained the power of secrets because you never knew what to make of a Facebook page where, it would say the Australian Patriot Nationalist Movement or whatever it was. And it was like, is this one person?
Yeah, or is it 5,000?
Yeah, the 5,000. What do I make of this? And the whole thing that you could never – it was hard to make out how much power was behind this, how many people were behind this, who was behind this. Are these – really, like, it gave these pages and these groups, therefore, power because there was mystery. And with mystery, there's power.
We have seen, though, a clear trend in groups and, I'm thinking specifically of Islamic State here, who've turned their online recruitment into something of an art form. And given that, particularly here in Australia, I don't think we really have many issues with dodgy imams preaching hate and things like that. And there's a part of me that wonders that if these people would be drawn to this type of ideology if it wasn't possible for these people overseas to sort of reach into their lives via mediums like Facebook and actually start radicalizing them. I mean, what's your take on that? Because you've actually spent time with people who are now in prison for trying to flee Australia to join Islamic State.
Yeah, in the case, I mean, it was just sort of I end up hanging out with who I hang out with. And so in the case of my Islamic State supporter dudes, they were more on the front foot, you know, very active, and like they weren't sweet little innocent they were more likely to be the ones putting other people under a spell rather than the ones. Right.
They were the recruiters, not the recruitees. But we've got to
be a bit careful. Just because there's people awaiting trials and stuff like that. So I'm just talking generally rather than specifically about anyone. But
they had to start somewhere, I guess, is my point, right? Where would they have picked up this bent previously? Do you think they would have been able to seek it out in other types of literature, or, you know, like, or would they have found a funny radical Islamic bookstore? Do you know what I mean? In a funny industrial area?
I think they would have. I think there's still sort of like a lot going on in the margin. So I think with the Islamic State, they'd be able to kind of survive with Facebook Messenger and other ways. And it's just hard to kind of prove, or at least for me, like, just because maybe it hasn't been the area I'm looking in. But I think Islamic State is sort of would be going strong, and they are good at putting out these promotional videos that look like cool Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise trailers, and it's fascinating. I got to see some of them because my Islamic State supporter friends would show me, and there would be these trailers that, and they've got an American voice over, or at least someone pretending to be an American voice over, and it really is like a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible trailer, and they've got like cool graphics. And
I mean, did you find yourself watching some of these videos and thinking, cool?
Well, no, just because there was a bit uncanny valley thing, you know, that thing where something's a bit just slightly odd.
No,
I wasn't thinking of joining Islamic State. But anyway, I think the interesting thing about those trailers, what it kind of can explain to outsiders, is it shows how much for Islamic State it is based on like scripture and religion and things like they're not that concerned about culture. I'm kind of explaining this the wrong way around. Let me explain it another way. Is the Islamic State supporters I hung out with, for them it was all about religion and scripture, and they were kind of shitty about Muslims who added cultural aspects to things like Arabness. So they were like, oh, listen, if you're a Muslim, you shouldn't really be too worried or concentrating on your Lebanese food or your Palestinian background or whatever, because it's all about the Islamic State, and it's all about we have to bring about the Messiah, like their version of the Messianic age. And they sort of like weren't – they're kind of a bit cynical about like cultural aspects of Islam, or, you know, like – yeah, like Arabness. So for instance, in these trailers, it can be a bit confusing. Like, why are they making them so much like American things? Aren't they just really hostile towards Hollywood and stuff? But to me, it makes total sense because they actually don't care how they get people into it. And like, it's not like their hatred of America is like they wouldn't like American trailers or anything like that. So it makes total sense that they'd leverage anything to try to sell their wares.
It strikes me that everyone involved, from the way out there, you know, left-wing Marxists to the right-wing flag-waving, you know, anti-immigrant nationalists to the some of the more serious rabbis to, you know, everyone it seems, and of course the Islamic State people, there seems to be this common thread among all of them. They seem so remarkably similar. Is that the key takeaway, do you think, for you? Is that what you walked away from this with?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily morally similar, but they are similar in this way, in that they all want to upend society. So,
but they all think that it's going to be rebuilt in their image, right? Like all of them.
Yeah, I mean, but this is where it can get confusing because people can think, oh, they want to make little changes. So, for instance, maybe the people on the far left, because of the way they're pitching themselves, like, oh, we're against Islamophobia, you could be thinking, oh, their real end game is that, oh, people stop picking on women in hijabs on trains or something, but it's not. They have a problem with capitalism and neoliberalism and just society, and they want to upend it. And it's the same with the far right or the white nationalists. Like you could think, oh, oh, they've got a problem with political correctness, or they've got a problem with feminism or something. And but then it's not that. It's like they want to upend society. And again, they just have a problem with how the materialistic way they think, and the non-spiritual way they think the West is operating at the moment. And obviously that's the same with the Islamic State dude. So everyone wants to upend society. And the other thing, because I cover this from mid 2015, and I kind of end the book at Trump's election. And the thing that was like chugging along in the background was the unexpected rise of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Because now we've kind of got used to Donald Trump, and we think, oh, you know, he's another whatever corrupt politician or whatever people think about him. But he's kind of been normalized in our minds pretty quickly, when really at the time it was all the money was going to Jeb Bush. That was how it was meant to happen. It was meant to be like all the powerful interests in the Republican Party, in big business, everyone was behind Jeb Bush. And then this fringe guy who'd just say anything and would like attack Wall Street, you know, which was Donald Trump, and attack the Iraq war. And like he was leaving Jeb Bush, you know, in a dust storm or whatever. And the same with Bernie Sanders on the left. And so all the radicals I was hanging out with, regardless of like obviously the far left weren't supporting Donald Trump, and obviously the Islamic State people weren't supporting Donald Trump or whatever, but regardless, it didn't matter. They just saw the rise of these two figures as proof that now's the time, now's the moment that, you know, society is going to be upended, because the general public is open to radical thoughts and open to different ways of thinking.
That's it. And I remember too, I mean, one of the freakiest things was when you were speaking with one of these, you know, Islamic State supporters, who was saying they didn't really have much of a problem with the right-wing nationalists here in Australia, because they said fundamentally they want the same thing.
Yeah, they wanted the same thing, in so much as they want Muslims to – these Islamic State supporters in Australia, they want Muslims to leave Australia and go to Syria and northern Iraq, and the UPF wants to kick out Muslims. So
it's a win-win.
This dude was saying it was the same. I mean, and the other interesting thing about that is how much the Islamic State dudes I spoke to, they just do not make any distinction between like being a small L liberal or being a conservative. They are not there kind of going, oh, we feel a bit better about America now because they voted in a black man, and you know, he's like putting out messages that you shouldn't be Islamophobic or whatever. Like they just do not think that way. And there's just like such, I mean, I think it was in a way, I mean, how do you prove these things? But how come at that Ariana Grande concert, why do they go there? Why there's like right-wing anti-Islam groups in Europe, you know, like what the English Defence League or something in UK. Why did the suicide bomber not go there? Why did he go to this rock concert? And it's because they're just not thinking in the same way that that you might want them to think. like where it's like, oh, the English Defence League, they're really bad because they're Islamophobic. But then there's Ariana Grande and there's these mainstream people and like they're good. They're good people. And, you know, she puts out a song about love or something. And you know, isn't she? She's like some non-white background. They're just not thinking the way you think. And it's the same with Charlie Hebdo. It's like, why did the shooters go and kill these cartoonists? Why didn't they go to the National Front, you know, like a far right?
Yeah, why didn't they go and try to suicide bomb Marine Le Pen? Yeah, and it's not the point.
Yeah, exactly. But what was... they're just not – they're, unfortunately for people who want things to be easy, it's not simple, and that's one way it's not simple.
Well, and the other thing is too, you know, you can often define a lot of these groups that you've profiled in your book by who they hate, right? More than what their objectives are. And I was quite surprised that it seems overwhelmingly to be the case that the right-wing sort of nationalist movement here in Australia, their biggest problem is not actually with immigrants, which is what they love to talk about. They see that as being a convenient way to get the conversation started, but they hate the Marxists. Do you know what I mean? If those guys were going to go around bombing anyone, it'd be the Marxists, not a mosque, you know, which is just, considering their rhetoric, it's a little bit backwards, right?
Well, I mean, it is interesting. I don't know enough about it, but it, and also I've got to be careful because it's the trial hasn't happened yet. But it is the one dude who has been arrested.
Now, this is from the right wing, right? This is the guy who was arrested. Right, we've actually had a right winger on terrorism charges in Australia.
Yeah, so he's still his trial hasn't happened or whatever, and so this is all just accusations. But he, it is interesting that what the police are saying that he done, and it's only allegations, is about, threats towards the socialist groups. Like you just said, it wasn't like, oh, it's threats against mosques. But, I mean, there's such, I think one way of trying to understand this real complex thing is making a separation between the leadership of these far-right groups and the people who rock up to the rallies. Because the people who rock up to the rallies can be just, Christ, they can be anyone. They can be like someone who votes liberal or votes, or is fed up with political correctness or hate.
They're there for whatever random reason, right? Like, and I did notice that myself. But the leadership,
they can be in the realms of being centre right or something like that. Whilst the leadership, in many cases, they're like super radical, like with super radical theories that are just so unpalatable to the mainstream and probably unpalatable to the people who even turn up to the rallies. Like if the United Patriots Front started talking about, hey, black people and white people, we've got different DNA and we have to segregate, it's not like Reclaim wouldn't have been able to get up based on that, Reclaim Australia, which is almost like this weird umbrella group of them all. Or as they start talking about the Jewish bankers or whatever. So they always would have to, massage their message into something like more palatable.
I believe the correct term these days is globalists, John. Come on, man, update your lingo.
Yeah. So, but that's kind of why the movement worked, or for a short term, Reclaim Australia. It's got these radical people were reframing their radical leaders were reframing their radical ideas as kind of mainstream concerns. So, there's this thing I define as like today, tonight, anti-Islam. And that might be, you're worried about a shoddy sheikh, or maybe you're worried about what they're talking in mosques about, the lynch siege, or halal, maybe halal, even that's a bit weird, halal certification. But something that's like really practical and in the mainstream and acceptable to be on today, tonight. So these radical leaders who actually had way more radical thoughts than that, to do with race, they saw that, hey, you can get away with saying this on Today Tonight, so I'm going to bend what I really believe, which is all about race and eugenics and Nazism and stuff, and bend it so I'm pretending that my concern is about halal certification or something like that.
I mean, there's Blair Cottrell, right, who's one of the far-right leaders here, who, once said that all school children should be given a copy of Mein Kampf and there should be a picture of Adolf Hitler in classrooms. And this is the guy who now has tried to sort of morph this into a political movement for
about
the dispossessed second right and talking about halal certification. And you get these stark admissions out of him in this book where he just says, we are talking about this because it's what's resonating. But the end game is to upset society, turn it over, and then rebuild patriots,
I mean, because one of the most interesting things about Blair Cottrell is if you listen to his speeches, he hardly ever mentions Islam. And so it's like, it's really odd considering he's meant to be the leader of this anti-Islam group. And you play any speech he says, he's never going into details about this and that. It's always, he's always talking about the bigger picture, like the puppet masters who are actually controlling things, and that Islam would never be a problem if not for the puppet masters. And if you're going to be generous to him, like you could say, he's talking about the Marxists or he's talking about globalization. And if you're going to be a bit more cynical, you say, well, he's talking about the Jews. And but the point being, he's it's not like he came into existence because he was shitty with halal certification. He's been on this train for a while. And in fact, one of the interesting things, this isn't in the book, but I watched his very first speech at the first Reclaim rally, and his brother or his friend is wheeling in this speaker on a little pushy thing, and then he stumbles over the word Islamification. That's how sort of unfamiliar he was with the whole thing with Islam. Like, he's, he's stumbling over words because he can't even pronounce them.
So he's basically a Nazi who jumped on the anti-Islam bandwagon because it was suitable to his medium-term agenda, which is, you know, and it does really come through in the book. But also what comes through in the book is that, to a degree, the sort of ballooning, right-wing patriots movement, so-called patriots movement, and that's what the book is largely concerned with. It's been a bit of a bubble, you know? I mean, and now they've sort of folded it up. Pauline Hanson, who's a far right-wing Australian politician, she's scooped up a few Senate seats and they're sort of saying, let's get behind her. And they've more or less packed their tents and run off.
Oh, so does this podcast, this goes to people outside Australia, does it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, because there's some real interesting things that to outsiders that, you know, would find interesting because it's not like it is in America or whatever. There was this global anti-Islam day that was organized by America, an American, this guy in Arizona, and it was like all over the world, we're going to have a day of solidarity with everyone to fight against Islam. And it flopped everywhere in the world except for in Bendigo in Victoria, Australia, like so where I was covering it. Like they got 1,000 people here and so that says a lot of interesting things about Australia, that an Arizona dude can call a global anti-Islam day and it even flops in Arizona but still works in, you know, Australia. I think the other thing that might be interesting to people outside Australia is, and also what distinguishes how this works in like Australia compared to Europe, is I really felt that this radical right, this ultra right wingness doesn't work for a crowd unless it's covered as, and unless it's disguising itself as being very normal. So when the far right started to grow on the streets, it was in Australia, it was the reason it was suddenly working mid 2015 is because these radical leaders had figured a way to market it as being totally normal and just middle of the road. And so like, you're almost like, oh, we're just patriotic people who like want to wave the flags for Australia. And so that's when I started getting a crowd. And then as soon as the cracks started to show and people saw, no, this is radical, that's when the crowd started to fall off. So in my book, I talk about that dude getting arrested, the far right, or a dude getting arrested who was connected with the United Patriots Front, and he's on all the news and he's being shuffled into the police car and they're talking about how they found some literature about bomb making in his house. And then the crowds really thinned out after that because it was like, hang on, this isn't normal.
These people make bombs. My favorite moment in the book was when you had Blair Cottrell, the Nazi, standing outside the Princess Theatre in Melbourne. Behind him is lettering advertising Fiddler on the Roof. And he's standing there talking about respecting his heritage and being proud of his heritage. And it's delicious, John. It's delicious.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something where, because I'm Jewish myself, that was like something where I was trying to bring up about how all these things are awkward and don't land easily. So it's like if Jews get to say we're the chosen few, you know, compared to the non-Jews, and if Muslims get to say that they're, you know, their version of that compared to the infidels, it's like kind of like weird. And you have these like Blair Cottrell saying, no, us white people are the chosen and compared to the non-whites. And it's just like weird.
That's what I was getting at earlier, where I say it comes across like they're all the same. They are all the same. And you say, okay, they're not morally equivalent. And that's true in a lot of the cases, but the core thing driving these people seems to be that view. We are the chosen ones. It's our world, right? Which is just, to me, an extremist view because I'm not religious.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in that whole thing of, yeah, like religion versus ethnicity versus race, and like how you kind of slide things into their different categories, and yeah, it is sort of I don't know, awkward at least, but I'm happy with loose ends. I think the reason I find it so easy to write, not easy, but I can write about this stuff and, you know, go on this adventure is because I never think, oh, unless I tie all the pieces together neatly, I shouldn't sort of start exploring it or whatever. So that, yeah, like say Blair Cottrell talking about tradition while standing in front of the Fiddler on the Roof musical, because it was in front of a musical theater, and you know that shows all about tradition, it is like that's enough for me to write about, rather than me tying up all the pieces of what exactly does it mean?
It's absurd where you don't expect it to be absurd. The book is fantastic. John Safran, thank you very much for joining us on the show to talk to us about it.
Thank you very much.
That was John Safran there. His book is called Depends What You Mean by Extremist, and it's out through Penguin. As best I can tell, it's not available in the United States, but you can grab an ebook version from Kobo's Australian store, and I don't think they did their geofencing right, so do make sure you grab a copy. Honestly, you will not regret it. The link is in this week's show notes. I should point out, too, that Blair Cottrell, this is Australia's Richard Spencer, I guess you'd call him, he didn't actually know he was standing in front of a theatre showing Fiddler on the Roof when he was addressing his rally about, you know, Anglo traditions and how traditions are special. Tradition! Okay, on to this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Bug Crowd. They, of course, do outsourced bug bounty programs. Casey Ellis, the founder and CEO of Bug Crowd, was in Australia last week to attend AusCert, and I went to see his talk. Now, basically, it was his 50-minute pitch, but it wasn't a boring pitch, and it really did tell the story of how bounties have evolved. When Casey started the company, I don't think anyone really knew how bounty programs would end up actually being used by organizations. Would companies like Bug Crowd just host the security at address and handle the payroll side of things, or would it be more involved? Would they be big programs? Would they be hosting big programs or little programs, continuous or point in time? Would people set a wide scope or a narrow scope? Would it be open? Would it be closed? And as it turns out, the answer to all of those questions is mostly just yes, right? People are using them in all sorts of ways, but it's clear that some norms are emerging. He had some interesting case studies in there too, in his slide deck. Some companies are now using bounties to do like rapid fire assessments on new acquisitions, which makes an awful lot of sense to me. I remember interviewing Adobe CISO Brad Arkin years ago about that. And I think at the time they were handling something like 2 acquisitions a month or something crazy, or 1 every 2 months. I can't remember. But yeah, a lot of acquisitions. So there's a use case where bounties work well. They're cheap and they find the worst stuff, the glaring stuff, very, very quickly. Now, as opposed to a case study, one trend Casey has noticed is people using bug bounty programs to free up internal resources to focus on things like architecture review or other internal programs. The way he explained it is that, bug bounty programs can deliver high impact results, but where they absolutely excel is in the simple stuff, bread and butter web app flaws like crappy OAuth implementations, logic bugs, cross-site scripting, and, you know, CSRF, that sort of stuff. Now, he describes those issues in his talk as simple. But by that, he doesn't mean easy. I interviewed Casey at AusCert as AusCert wrapped up on the Gold Coast last week, and here's what he had to say.
The definition I'd use of simple there is actually like more commoditized. So testing that's, you know, discrete bits of information that get found, that's usually, you know, the less complicated issues or issues in web apps and infrastructure and things like that. But sometimes it's more complicated stuff. So the technical variation in what that can mean is pretty broad. But the whole idea of like there's commodity work that a security team does, and then there's work that requires, it's higher order. Like it's things like, you know, rewriting architecture or training users or things that have a trailing responsibility that the crowd's not actually good for. And part of what I was calling out in the talk is how we're seeing organizations shift their internal team from doing this commodity work themselves to be able to work on the higher order stuff whilst bringing in the crowd to basically fill the gap that leaves.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like people don't find good bugs. I mean, that's, yeah, not what I mean. And it was funny because we had that guy, and his name evades me right now, but the guy who wrote the book on OAuth 2, right? Yeah. And he was like, yeah, you know, he had a great old time doing bug bounties because there are like a couple of common mistakes that people would make that's like auth bypass tends to pay pretty well, right? Yep. So he had a great old time. So there's also that, isn't there, where someone might find a trick that works across a whole bunch of programs and then just come in and hit a whole bunch of them at once, right? Yeah. And that's valuable stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that particular issue, it might be the same guy. Like Covert Redirect, when that came out, it was a combination of a weakness, not a vulnerability, but a weakness in OAuth 2, combined with very kind of common bad developer behavior. It probably came from Stack Overflow or somewhere. There's some code snippet that everyone just copy-pasted. And we saw it come through the platform, you know, 4 or 5 times across different programs before there was a big kind of outbreak of awareness around it. And it's exactly that. It's people that, you know, understand a particular class or style of vulnerability that exists and is pervasive, and they just go out and scan the internet for it.
How many people out there are actually doing that? Like, they're specialists and they might discover some sort of new thing that people are doing wrong, and then they just hit it up and, like, you know, rip $100,000 out of the bounty programs, and then that awareness comes up, those problems disappear, and then they go away to think about the next one.
That's a really interesting question. We get, you know, it's something that gets brought up a lot around, like, when things like Heartbleed happen, right? It's like, oh, well, you know, is that deserving of a bounty because it's already a known issue now? There's so much, you know, publicity and interest, and there's a patch and all that other stuff. But then the reality is not necessarily everything gets patched, and that actually becomes the risk. So the fact that they're exploiting a known vulnerability, quote-unquote, is not really the thing. It's the fact...
Yeah, but a Heartbleed you fix with a patch, like a shitty OAuth implementation is kind of a different thing, right?
Same principle applies. So you're talking, you know, what you're really talking about is an individual finding...
Well, one's op teams, one's developer team, right? So it is kind of different.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying there. I think the way I'm thinking about that is a bug is a bug. So, but yeah, if someone finds a particular issue that they feel is pervasive and widespread, then usually they'll go out and look for it everywhere. And then they'll continue to look for it in like more, unique kind of deployment use cases and things like that. So you can see something like on the front door, you go scan everyone's front door, that's easy and it's obvious, but then you drill deeper and you can find the same issue deeper down. And that happens over a period of time. We see a lot of people do that. Like everyone, you know, who comes in from a security testing background, they can do essentially the full spectrum of different types of tests, but they've usually got their, you know, two or three favorites at any given time that they'll actually optimize their workflow around. Because
that makes sense, right? Because there's people are good at different things, which is kind of your whole business model.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing for them is that they're incentivized to be first. So what they want to do is to be able to be efficient in how they go out and find this thing that they've discovered that they're really good at identifying in as many places as possible to beat other people to that bug, so that they get the reward for it. So that's actually part of, it's an interesting side effect of the model that kind of gets this continuous coverage thing out of it, if that makes sense.
One of the things you touched on early on in your talk was actually the concept of technical debt. Yep. Were you arguing that using a bounty program is actually good for remedying technical debt, or were you arguing that it's, you know, the bounty programs are actually useful for just identifying technical debt, and you know, particularly when it pertains to security? Like, you know, oh my God, this particular platform that we operate is so bad, we should just like throw it in the bin.
I think, you can't, it's difficult to remedy something without having identified it first. So, you know, we don't step in there and say, hey, here's how you're going to fix absolutely everything. But, you know, what we often see, it's the initial phase of a bounty program. It's basically, you know, what I call clearing assurance debt. Like, that's actually the phrase that I use to describe it. And it's the stuff that people have had lingering around as vulnerabilities in their systems forever, but they've never had the firepower to actually identify it. And every company's got that. Like, the older the company, the more there is.
I'd imagine too, like, after an organization is over a certain size, right? Like, that's going to be a winner for you, right?
Because growth through acquisition.
Yeah, because you come in and you just go, okay, like, we'll throw, you know, X thousand people at it, and in they come, and then you're sort of clearing the decks, right?
Yeah, and that's really like the first phase of any program is that, like, what didn't we know that we didn't know? That we're now able to find out.
You're getting all Rumsfeldian on us now.
Yeah, well, you know, you move to the US, you start to pick up a few statements like that and throw them around. But yeah, I mean, that's really what it is. It's figuring out what the unknown unknowns are, given that you've got better ability to identify them. And there's a phase of that, after which point you settle into steady state, which is where it gets interesting, because you're basically at that point preventing future technical debt. You know, you're catching stuff and creating that feedback loop that actually educates engineering teams to get better at not putting this shit out there in the first place as time goes by.
Yeah, you were saying too that there's some teams where they actually use the rate of reported bugs into the bounty program as pretty much a metric to figure out who to spank, right?
Yeah, and also to measure the effectiveness of their overall security program. Like, people that think about bounty in particular, like public bounty, as an overall, like, crowdsourced adversarial simulation, as opposed to we're you know, honing it in, doing AppSec testing or infrastructure testing or whatever else. So people that just look at it as, we'll pay people if they break our stuff. that becomes a really good proxy metric for how much they've increased the cost of attack, right? When you think it through, like that's basically what we're simulating. So what we've seen is you know people actually using that as the core KPI for the effectiveness of their overall security program, actually in the boardroom, and measuring that over time, which is an interesting development, I think. You know, there's people that we're talking to now around the idea of the amount that they're paying out and how much they push their top end payouts as a proxy indicator of how much they've really increased attacker cost. Because when you think about it, it's not exactly one-to-one, but it's I think as pure as you're going to be able to get it.
So it's almost like when you're paying bigger bounties less frequently, that's good.
Yeah. When you're paying bigger bounties less frequently, what it's an indicator of is that's the same cost that you've incurred to a real world attacker at that point.
That's a really interesting idea. Casey, we're going to wrap it up there so we can all have a drink and relax at the end of OSCET. Thank you very much for joining us on the show, and thanks again, as always, for sponsoring the program.
Cheers, Pat. Thank you.
That was BugCrowd's Casey Ellis there. Big thanks to him for that. And do go on over to bugcrowd.com to check out what they can do for you. And honestly, if you're an organization of any type of scale, this is something you want to do. Now, whether that's for asset discovery, like finding out when developers have spun up something stupid and that's wound up on the internet, or whether it's for assessing your technical debt or cleaning up your, just basic cleanup of web app flaws, go to bugcrowd.com, dip your toe in. That is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.